Hello and welcome to the programme. You can visit our website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. Today, Terry Flanagan reports on what you should and shouldn't feed birds and why it matters.
Birds are very conscious of their weight. If you lift a bird in the hand, like a pigeon, you'd be amazed at how light it is. And the reason why they're so conscious of this weight is because they have to fly. And the heavier they are, the harder it is for them to get off the ground.
Niall Hatch talks to me about Lazarus species.
Well, a Lazarus species, Derek, it's a bird that has come back from the dead. So this bird here from Indonesia, the black-browed babbler, that was a species that was discovered in one of these collecting expeditions 170 years ago, but was never seen again. But a team working on the island of Borneo has rediscovered it. They found the first living specimens of this. But it does seem to be in quite a remote part of Borneo, probably been there undetected by people for a very long time.
And we talk to the director of Photo Wildlife Park in Cork, Sean McKeown, and discover why the park must reopen soon.
What's going on is that we're closed to the public. We've no people coming in for no income. And obviously we had the same thing last year, and 2020 was bad, and this year's looking like worse.
So, Sean, when you have no money coming in, how can you manage with your species and your wages? You have to pay for your staff. You have 135 species of animals there that you have to keep going, 75 of which are in danger of extinction in the wild. So you just can't give up. It's not a sideshow. This is a big conservation project, not just entertainment for the public. It's much more than that.
So, a very busy programme ahead of us today. Don't forget to visit that website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. Now, let's go straight away to our panel, starting with Aina Nilana in County Clare. How are you today, Aina?
I'm fine and dandy, as I always am, Derek, thanks be to goodness. And I'm really enjoying spring. The whole place is festooned with daffodils of all sorts. It looks really good. And the leaves are beginning to come on the hawthorn. They're beginning to come on the trees. So, you know, in spite of everything, spring is here.
Oh, well, it is really beautiful. Richard Collins is in Malahide. Richard, what's going on out there?
Hello, Derek. The first two summer migrants of the year, bird migrants, have arrived. And they are the same ones that arrive every year, the gannet and the sandwich tern. They only arrived the last few days. They're a little late this year. I think it's because the winds didn't favour their coming. They don't fly against the wind if they can avoid it. But they're there now. It's the change in the year.
The sandwich tern, named after the town of Sandwich in Kent, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, it's in southern England. I think it's Kent, but I always get confused about the English counties. There's an Earl of Sandwich, and it is where the sandwich was made, putting bits of meat between two bits of bread or something like that. By the Earl of Sandwich, I think, gave us the word sandwich. It's also the name of the tern.
Well, as the Corrigan brothers said in their song many years ago, it's amazing what you learn on the Mooney Show. Anyway, Aina, I'm delighted to have you today because we're at the end of National Tree Week. And I noticed, not too far away from where you live, the finest specimen of a monkey puzzle tree I've ever seen in my life, just there in Terranure near Bushy Park. Now, the reason it came to my mind was when I was a kid in Donnybrook, I used to go to St. Mary's Primary School on Belmont Avenue. And as we were walking up Belmont Avenue, there's a house there that has a monkey puzzle tree. And I've often wondered, where does it get the name monkey puzzle? Why is it called monkey puzzle? And what's it got to do with monkeys in the first place? Or does it have anything to do with them?
Do you want me to tell you now, or are you just musing? Because, as you know, I know everything, and I know why this is it too.
Go on.
This tree comes from Chile. It's the national tree of Chile, where there are no monkeys, you'll be glad to know, none at all, to be puzzled or otherwise. And it was brought over to England by a fellow called Archibald Menzies, who was a plant collector, and he brought it over in 1795. And of course, in those days, the more money you had to spend on posh and exotic things, the swankier you were, like nowadays. Only then the swanky things people wanted to buy were trees. So this fellow down in Cornwall, he planted a tree, one of these. It cost him 20 guineas to buy the seedling. That would be the equivalent of about 2,000 euros in today's money. And a barrister came to visit him and said, when he touched the spiky leaves, Lord, he said, it would puzzle a monkey to climb up that. And from 1850 onwards, the term monkey puzzle stuck to the tree. It was called Acuparia before then. It had obviously got native names in Chile from whence it came, but it was puzzle a monkey to climb it, and it surely would. It's a tree that survives, Derek, from the time of the dinosaurs, 145 million years ago to 65 million years ago, because the herbivorous dinosaurs ate everything in sight, but they couldn't eat this one. So really it should be called a dinosaur puzzle rather than a monkey puzzle. So the dinosaurs got wiped out, but this tree didn't. And it grows for about 1,300 years before it dies. I hope the people in Terranure like it, because it's going to be there longer than their houses ever are going to be. But it was the real status symbol to have in those days.
Fantastic. I tell you, the specimen that's in Terranure is dwarfing the house. And I noticed also in Bushy Park, they've just planted a new one there as well.
They have, yes, and the council have planted one in Harold's Cross Park as well. They look great. They look like bottle brushes or something. And as the tree grows and becomes large, like the one in Terranure Garden, the bottom branches fall off. It's part of the way they grow. So the tree is actually straight pole up the middle, and then this amazing looking collection of branches around the top. It's really amazing. If you go down to Inishteague in County Kilkenny, there's a big house there, Woodstock, which was burnt down in 1922. But they actually have an avenue, if no less, an avenue of these monkey puzzles. So there's posh, which they planted in the 1840s. So you can imagine how it was a great status symbol. You couldn't go to Chile, you could plant the trees that came from there.
Now, if you've never seen one, you can go on the website rte.ie/Mooney and have a look. Any out your way, Richard?
Oh, yes. I mean, this is a very widely distributed tree. It grows very successfully in Ireland, I'm told, by gardeners and people. It is covered in scales. It's like a hedgehog in a funny sort of way, except they are scales. They're very prickly. Now, a possible explanation that has been suggested is that Chile is, of course, a land of volcanoes. Places are going on fire all the time. And this tree is, the branches are covered, everything is covered with scales. They're like mollusk shells or that sort of thing. And of course, it's very resistant to fire. And it will survive lava flows, I'm told. So this might explain how it came to have this rather curious thick bark. It's an interesting tree. It's actually edible. The grandee who brought it to Britain, they say, was at dinner with the Governor General or whatever they had in Chile back in the 19th century. And he took some seeds from the table and put them in his pocket. And he brought them to Britain, it seems. And he was probably bored to tears with the conversation and decided to collect chili pine seeds instead. But it's still eaten by the local people, and it's declared a national monument out there. But interestingly, it is declining. The International Union for the Conservation of Nature says that this tree is endangered. So after all, you know, we raise animals in captivity, rhinos and things that are declining in the wild. We raise them in zoos with the hope of returning them to the wild. And I think we should do the same with trees, should we not? Everyone says this is a way out of character in Ireland. And in a sense, it is out of character in Ireland. But by growing it here and in Europe generally, it is a protection if it does continue to decline through logging and burning and encroachment back in its native Chile.
Well, it's a beautiful tree, and we'll never look at them the same way again. Guys, stay there if you will, because Richard mentioned zoos just there, along with airlines and hospitality. Zoos and wildlife parks are among the worst hit sectors by COVID-19. And in line with local government guidelines, many had to close their doors to visitors for most of the past 12 months. Sadly, dozens of zoos from the United States to Europe may never reopen. You'll remember that even Dublin Zoo issued a fundraising appeal in November after announcing it was facing an existential threat due to the global pandemic. And now we see that Fota Wildlife Park must reopen and attract maximum visitors possible during peak summer months to make up for revenues lost over lockdown. So says director Sean McKeown, or they too could be facing permanent closure. Sean joins us now from Fota Wildlife Park in Cork. Sean, what's going on?
What's going on is that we're closed to the public. We've no people coming in for no income. And obviously we had the same thing last year. And towards the end, from March till sort of the end of May, And then towards the end of the year, we had restrictions in as well. So 2020 was bad, and this year's looking like worse.
Now, when you say bad, can you paint a picture for us, please, if you don't get people through the gates?
We were basically 95% or more of our income is from visitors paying at the gate coming in, either as individual punters coming in or as members or season ticket holders.
So, Sean, when you have no money coming in, how can you manage with your species and your wages? You have to pay for your staff. You have 135 species of animals there that you have to keep going, 75 of which are in danger of extinction in the wild. So you just can't give up. It's not a sideshow. This is a big conservation project, not just entertainment for the public. It's much more than that.
Absolutely. We can't furlough a giraffe or a rhino here. We can't close the door, switch off a light and walk away from it. We still have about 70% of the staff on site that we normally have, and that's to feed the animals, look after them. There's veterinary bills, there's heating, lighting, etc. They're all there. Normally, we would make this money. We're a bit like an animal, particularly from the northern hemispheres. We sort of come out of hibernation in April, maybe even in Patrick's Day, if we're lucky enough with the weather. And from then on till about the end of September, we're putting on as much fat in terms of our income to survive the winter. That's how it's worked for the last 38 years.
And of course, FOTA is extremely popular with the public. I mean, people are anxious to come, and every year you have new arrivals, things to be seen. People love the idea of an outdoor park rather than a zoo as such. So it's really an attraction. It's not the fact that people aren't coming, it's the fact that they can't come. In fact, if the restrictions were lifted, your numbers would probably double, as people are so anxious to get out and about. And there's been a huge increase in the amount of interest the public have in wildlife and nature anyway. So, you know, you should reap the benefit if the restrictions were to be lifted. So is there any hope that they will now, coming up after Easter?
We would hope they would. But we have the oddities of the Arboretum, which is run by the OPW next door. That's all, you know, there are people that are going around it. It's open to the public. And there are a number of other sites around the country that are open, particularly non-paying sites. But, you know, us as a paying site, we can limit the number of visitors to 200, 300 or 500, whatever it is, at any one time within the park very easily, because people have to book beforehand and they have to give us their email to book. We can, you know, we have a good tracing mechanism there if there is an issue.
Sean, can I look at this from a slightly different perspective, that of the animals? I remember going with you down to your lion enclosure, and the lion responded to your presence. You were able to whistle and it would come out. It seems to me the animals develop a reciprocal relationship with keepers and visitors. And the effect of closing down the zoo on the animals, what is that effect? Do animals get distressed? Do they get depressed? Because the usual group of people isn't coming to look at them and the keeper isn't there to be with them.
Well, the animal staff are there as normal, and we give them more enrichment than normal. But there's no doubting that a lot of the animals do know certain people. As you say, the lions, the tigers would know the animal staff, myself, anybody they see on a regular basis, and that could be regular visitors as well. Primates are particularly so. They, you know, like humans, they're very social, and they can recognise people from a long way off. But it's not just the animals; it's the human aspect that people, when they're in the outdoors and particularly being around animals, get a certain physiological and psychological boost. And it really relaxes them. And we have a lot of people who come in here who really appreciate the park being open, just from that point of view, not necessarily to see individual animals. It's just the general atmosphere that they really enjoy.
Well, now, you're not alone. Your zoo. Zoos all over the world must be in trouble. And a lot of zoos must be closing, never to open again. And there are all these animals costing a fortune to keep. So there must be a wholesale transfer and transporting of animals. Now, if you had to shed animals, who would pay the cost of moving, say, Indian rhinos to Britain or France or somewhere, or giraffes, big heavy animals like that? Is there a universal and international problem with this?
Obviously, COVID is an international issue. Some countries have dealt with it in different ways. For instance, the German, a lot of the German zoos opened quite early last year, were open all winter, up until quite recently when the third wave of COVID, that has caused a lot of those to close. In other countries, they have left their zoos open. So particularly in Scotland and, you know, go to places like Denmark or Sweden, they would take a different attitude to the interaction of people and animals. And particularly, we are outdoors, where we have no indoor areas open for the public to visit. It's literally only toilets. That's the only thing that they can visit indoors.
And, of course, people, as you said, love to see animals, and particularly they love to see new baby animals. I see you had a new baby bison there before Christmas. Are there more babies expected? What's the story on the maternity front? Have you other animals that will have young that would be even a greater attraction for people coming along in springtime?
Springtime is the normal period for a lot of the births here. Some of the species, like our tigers and lions, we, as part of the program, we're asked not to breed in particular years because we want to regulate the numbers in the zoos, and we breed from animals that are genetically more important that wouldn't have had so many offspring. So we are in that situation now with our lions and tigers. We have a male tiger called Dash. He is due to go off to Chester Zoo. And because of Brexit, that's been delayed. I mean, there's lots of activities around the world that cause headaches for us, but Brexit has delayed that because now the UK would be seen as a third country in terms of CITES. Normally, we'd have just done a blood test, make sure the animal's healthy before it's sent off, and then it can go off within, you know, a few weeks. But we've had this with a number of animals here that we've currently not been able to move on because of issues around Brexit and ferries been delayed, etc. So there's no way we would try and send an animal like a rhino. We have one of our male rhinos to go to France for breeding there. That can't go there until there is a normal running and no delays of ferries going from Ireland to France. So there's probably 3-4% of zoos have closed. But if this goes on to later in the year, when there's a number of restrictions, there will be more zoos closed worldwide, or certainly reduce in size and numbers of species kept there. And that is a worry because, you know, if you take our things like our ringtail lemurs, our black and white ruffed lemurs, when the park opened here 38 years ago, there was about 500,000 ringtail lemurs. There's 3,200 left in the wild. There's that number in captivity. And it's even worse for the black and white ruffed lemurs. So in the mid-80s, there was about 250,000 of those in the wild. Now it's about 250. The work we do in trying to save species from extinction is becoming much more important. It's not for just to look and wonder at animals that we are doing here. It's about reintroduction and things like the bison, even early species like Nantajack cobes. We're actually breeding corncrakes at the moment. And we're doing research around ladybirds in Ireland and the invasive harlequin ladybird that's potentially having a devastating effect on our native species of ladybirds.
So your message is that we need to open up and open up soon?
Ideally, yes. But obviously, There's factors outside there that I think Nefidon would like to see less people movement around, but I think it's about contacts indoors more than so much contact outdoors. And I think it's that needs to stop.
Sean, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Derek.
Needless to say, we wish Sean and his team who look after the animals and indeed the visitors to Foto Wildlife Park the very best of luck, and hopefully you can open again soon. We are here to support you in any way we can. Now, let's lighten the mood a little bit, because I saw a headline in The Guardian the other day which caught my eye. It said, "Black-browed babbler found in Borneo 180 years after last sighting." And I read on. It says, "In the 1840s, a mystery bird was caught on an expedition to the East Indies. Charles Lucien Bonaparte, the nephew of Napoleon no less, described it to science and named it the black-browed babbler. The species was never seen in the wild again, and a stuffed specimen featuring a bright yellow glass eye was the only proof of its existence. But now," it says, "the black-browed babbler has been rediscovered in the rainforests of Borneo." Hooray! This is what's known as a Lazarus species. So who better to explain what a Lazarus species is and tell us about the black-browed babbler than Niall Hatch? Niall, let's start at the very beginning. What is a Lazarus species?
Well, a Lazarus species, Derek, it's a bird that has come back from the dead. It's
indeed
a species that... Exactly. So that's what it is. What happens is birds and other creatures as well are sometimes discovered during the Victorian era in particular. There are lots of explorers and naturalists, particularly from Britain and from Germany, Russia as well, who travelled quite widely in the world. And what they did was they used to collect specimens. Now, collecting specimens is a very polite way or clinical way of saying what they did was they shot everything they saw, stuffed it and took it back home to museums where it was catalogued, and that's how many of the species we know today were first described to science. It had to be a museum specimen of them that was the type specimen that the whole species was based on. So this bird here from Indonesia, the black-browed babbler, it's from part of the Indonesian part of Borneo, that was a species that was discovered in one of these collecting expeditions 170 years ago. It was labelled and in a museum drawer and was never seen again. So the original collector, they couldn't even be sure if his identification of the site was accurate, if his label on the specimen was giving a true indication of where the bird came from, because a lot of these collectors, they collected hundreds or even thousands of different birds, and they'd bring them all back in trunks and in cases back to these museums where they'd be sorted out, and sometimes labels would go missing or they'd be mislabeled to begin with. So that was thought to be the case with this black-browed babbler. But a team working on the island of Borneo just in recent times has rediscovered it. They found the first living specimen of this. And just to give you a description of what it looks like, it's quite an attractive bird in its own kind of muted way. It's greyish on the front and on the face. The back is kind of brown with kind of more reddish toned brown in the wings. It has a greyish black cap on top of its head, and then a very strong white mark just above the eye and above the beak, and then a big thick black stripe running right through the eye on either side of the head, and has a very distinctive dark red eye as well. And it's actually that eye that may have led to the confusion, because when birds are stuffed and skins are taken, the eyes don't survive that process. So very often they're fixed with glass eyes, and the eyes that were on the specimen in the museum drawer were the wrong colour. They were much paler. So people thought that this bird would have had originally yellow eyes, but no, it has red eyes, it seems. So that may be one of the reasons why it was undetected, but it does seem to be in quite a remote part of Borneo, probably been there undetected by people or by visitors for a very long time.
Yeah, you're saying these guys go out and they would collect a specimen by killing it and then bringing it back and stuffing it. But at what point is it given a name? Presumably when they've collected the bird for the first time, it is the first time. They're not going out collecting a specimen of something that they've already seen back in a museum or stuffed in a cabinet in some university back in the UK or wherever.
Yes, it's usually the case that the naturalist who first describes it, which isn't necessarily the same as discovering it, but whoever first describes it has the naming rights. From the Victorian era particularly, you have lots of birds and other creatures as well, and plants too, that are named after people. Mm. And it was considered very bad form to name it after yourself. You wouldn't do that. What you'd do is you'd name it after a colleague or a yep. peer in the hopes that they would then return the favour when they discovered something new. So that was sort of the etiquette that people had. There's been a move away from that now in recent times, that people think that a lot of naturalists and scientists believe that newly discovered organisms, rather than being named in honor of a person, they should be named after a physical feature or perhaps a geographic location that gives more information about the bird, it's more pertinent to it. But of course, what I'm saying is I'm talking about the scientific name. So the English name for this bird, the black-browed babbler, that's not necessarily set in stone. There's sort of conventions around those, but they change over time. Obviously, that's only the name in English. The name in other languages could be completely different. It's really the scientific name that counts for these. And once they are, the scientific name is chosen, they are set in stone unless some scientific discoveries show that perhaps they got the genus wrong. So the first part of the scientific name can change. The second part, the species name, usually remains fixed for all time.
Well, I'm looking at a picture of the bird now, and it's more grey and brown than it is black. And why is it called a babbler?
So the babblers are a big group of birds that are found across Asia, and they take many different roles. It's a very large avian family. Some of them behave a bit like warblers, creeping around in the trees and hopping around catching flies. Other ones spend time on the ground. And they're originating in that because some of the species would have had a very distinctive kind of babbling song. But it's not a particularly well-defined group. They're all genetically related to each other, but they don't all look the same. The closest relatives here in Ireland would be what we call the Sylvia warblers. So not getting too technical, they're the warblers that are in the genus Sylvia. The most common would be the black cap. So the black cap essentially is a type of babbler, and it's not related really to many of the other warblers in Ireland, like the willow warbler or the chiffchaff. Other examples in Ireland would be the garden warbler, also the white throat, and birds like that. They're part of this great babbler assemblage, but it's mainly an Asian group of species, and particularly in Southeast Asia, that's where the biggest radiation of them is. So there are many different species of babbler on Borneo, for example, and so this was one of them. And also, when people first discover these birds, when people, when they were shot and taken back, people never are fully sure if that's an adult male or a female necessarily, or if it's in full breeding plumage, because that's often difficult to discern. They can tell if it's male or female from analysing it, but sometimes that data gets lost. So sometimes, as well, birds have been discovered that turn out to be hybrids, and people have gone on a wild goose chase looking for these birds, and they only realise afterwards from genetic work that the species doesn't actually exist. It's a hybrid between two other species.
Oh, well, it's a beautiful bird, I have to say. It must be quite small also, because the photograph I'm looking at, the bird is, well, the guy's holding it in his hand and you can see his knuckles, so you can get some idea of perspective and scale. It's not a large bird.
No, it's not. It looks roughly maybe robin sized, I would say, from the picture. It's hard to get a full sense of the size of, but not a very large bird at all. And from its plumage, it looks very camouflaged. So my guess would be that this is a bird of the dense jungle, of the forest. Probably creeps around on the floor in the lower stories of the trees. So it would be very easy for to evade detection. A lot of these birds, obviously, the best way to find them and to survey for them is to listen for their songs, because all birds tend to have very distinctive songs, particularly in the tropics. But of course, this bird had never been accurately recorded before.
Well, no, 170 years ago, since it was last noted.
Yes, and nobody recorded the song at the time, so nobody knows what the song was like. So the bird may well have been calling and singing away there, in the open, without anyone realising that this was something significant.
Any other examples of Lazarus species, Niall?
Yes, it's something that happens a fair bit. And as ornithologists become more skilled and are travelling to further flung parts of the world, they are finding many of these species, especially ones that were described first in Victorian times and were then lost and not seen again. So a good example of that would be a bird called the Damar flycatcher, which is also from Indonesia. Indonesia has more unique or endemic birds than any other country in the world, by far the most. Number two is Australia, but Indonesia beats that, because Indonesia, of course, is a collection of islands spread over a very large part of the ocean, and some of those islands have Asian flora and fauna, some have Australasian, so they're very different. So this bird anyway was discovered back in 1898 by a collector, a German collector, I believe, and it went to the Rothschild family. Walter Rothschild was a British banker who was very interested in natural history and collecting these. There's some species indeed named after him. But it hadn't been seen since it originally collected until around in late 2001, a BirdLife International expedition to Indonesia actually then found this and were able to rediscover where the bird lived. And then, of course, when they found out what its habitat type was like and what its song was like, it became much easier to track it down. And very often it turns out that when they can pin it down, they realise that some of these birds are actually quite common. They've just been overlooked. So that was a bird that again came back from what was thought to be extinction, or at least from disappearance. Another one, a very attractive little bird that made a lot of headlines in recent years, is a bird called the Cebu flowerpecker. So Cebu is an island in the Philippines. Again, it's not a coincidence that many of these species are connected to islands, because many of these islands were heavily forested, very remote, and people don't necessarily go there. So that species had been known in the past, but had been presumed extinct in the late 50s. I think it was more or less declared extinct in 1959, because the island it lived on was completely cleared of forest. This was a forest bird, so it had completely disappeared. However, in 1992, it was rediscovered. It somehow had been able to cling on, maybe a little remnant patch of vegetation, though it was extremely extremely rare. So it was a bird that came back from the brink. And then what happened was that that meant that conservationists could then say, okay, this species still exists. We need to protect it immediately to try and change its fortunes. It's still not doing terribly well, but hopefully the rediscovery has come in time to save it. But that sort of fallacy there, that's what's called as a Romeo error after Romeo and Juliet. Because, of course, in the story of Romeo and Juliet, what happened was that the Juliet feigned her death, and then Romeo, believing that Juliet was dead, killed himself. And so it was down to a misunderstanding. He thought that this bird was extinct, and so the habitat was allowed to be destroyed. So that's why it's called a Romeo error.
It's fascinating stuff. It really is now. Niall, I've got a sound of a bird for you now. I want you to have a listen to this and tell me if you think you know what it is. Do you think it's a black-browed babbler that we've just been speaking about?
Well, Derek, as I was saying, I don't think anyone's recorded the sound of that bird yet, but I do know what this one is. This is an Irish bird, indeed. It's the hen harrier.
Indeed, it is the hen harrier. Now, I've never actually seen a hen harrier. Can you describe it for our listeners, please, Matt?
Oh, you've really missed out, Derek. They're a gorgeous bird. So the hen harrier is a bird of prey. So like most birds of prey, it has very broad, long wings. Actually, it's longer winged than most birds of prey would be because of its hunting style. And one of the most interesting things about hen harriers is that the males and the females look utterly different. You wouldn't think that they were the same species at all. And indeed, for centuries, they were thought to be separate species until people realized that one was the male and one was the female. So to describe the male, first of all, he, like with most birds of prey, is a bit smaller than the female, though still a large bird, a wingspan of around about a metre. He is a lovely sort of bluish grey above, a sort of very pale grey with a white rump, so white lower back, and black tips to his wings. And the female is a bit bigger, and she is brown and streaky overall. So she looks a bit more like a buzzard, I suppose, but she still has that big white patch on her lower back. And that's often the best way to identify them. Now, when you see a hen harrier, very often it's flying just above the ground slowly over a field. It's that kind of slow flight that's very typical. Other birds of prey either tend to dash from cover to try and catch their prey, like a sparrowhawk might, or maybe a peregrine falcon diving out of the sky, or a buzzard or an eagle would soar high in the sky looking out for things below them. The hen harrier, what it does, it flies very slowly over fields and over bogs, looking down to try and find prey by sight, but also by hearing. Like owls, they have this defined facial disc around their faces, so it's almost an owl-like face, and that helps to focus the sound into their ears to let them pinpoint them by sound alone.
Well, why am I talking about hen harriers? Well, it appears that the year 2020 was a very successful year for hen harriers. And this is great news for conservationists, as the species has been in decline in recent times due to changing agricultural and forestry practices and habitat loss, especially a loss of quality moorland where hen harriers like to hunt. Farmers now are being encouraged to look at alternatives to gorse burning in an effort to preserve scrub and moorland for the species. Fergal Monaghan is project manager of the Hen Harrier Programme, and he joins us now. Hello, Fergal. So can you tell me a little bit about this project and why you're so keen to get farmers involved, please?
Well, the hen harrier's population has decreased dramatically over the past 30 years. And it's necessary at this stage to try and improve the quality of the habitats that they depend on in their breeding grounds. And to do that, we have to engage with the farming community. We have to try and incentivize them to improve habitat quality and to address the risks that affect hen harriers.
What has the fate of the hen harrier got to do with the farmers?
Well, the farmers manage about 50% of the land in the special protection areas for hen harriers, and how they manage that land has a direct impact on the quality of the habitats for hen harriers and other species. So they're the people on the ground, and they're the people who will have to manage the habitats, and our role is to guide them and incentivize them in that.
Now, I know what incentivize means and I know what guide means, so can you give me an example of both, please, in this instance?
Yeah, we operate a results-based agri-environment programme where farmers are paid based on the quality of the habitats that they deliver on their farm. So if they can improve that quality, their payments go up, and if the quality of the habitat goes down, their payments will fall. That's where the incentive lies. And then the guidance, we work with farmers to identify issues on their farm. We invest with them in providing solutions to those challenges. because it's in our interest to do so if we want to protect hen harriers and other upland species.
Ah, yes, but what do you actually do with them? What do you tell them to do? How can they manage their land differently for the benefit of hen harriers?
Well, for example, one of the things we want to do is to reduce the risk of wildfires. And a farmer can do quite a lot in that regard. If we look at the two most flammable plants in the uplands, we have gorse, which is a spiny yellow shrub that most people should be familiar with. And we found that if the farmer can control gorse where that's necessary by grazing with horses in late winter and early spring. We've also found that if we look at grass fires, which are very important in the uplands, the risk of them can be reduced by grazing with cattle in June and July. So just getting the right type of animal in the right place at the right time is the key to reducing wildfire risk.
Fergal, I know that gorse and brambles are both incredibly spiky plants, very well defended. I find it surprising that any animals at all would want to eat them. Is that something that these livestock will readily do?
Yeah, well, if some livestock, like goats and horses, are well equipped to manage spiny shrubs like brambles and horses, other animals like cattle probably wouldn't be able to cope. A cow grazes by grabbing vegetation with its tongue and lips and ripping it away, which doesn't work very well with a spiny shrub, whereas a horse or a goat bites the vegetation off. And it's very interesting with the horse, they'll bite off the gorse stem and they'll turn it in their mouth and swallow it so that the stems fold back along the stem and don't hurt their mouth. So it's an ingenious technique.
And how are hen harriers doing in Ireland at the moment? Was 2020 a good breeding season for them?
2020 was a reasonable year. In the six SPAs, we had 58 pairs that reared at least 60 chicks. Outside of the six special protection areas, there wouldn't be accurate figures. So 2020 wasn't a bad year. 2019 was a fantastic year where we had over 80 chicks, and we'd be hoping that many of them would be old enough to breed this year. So we're hoping to see an increase in the number of pairs in the next month or so.
As I understand it, Fergal, 2019 was a rather technical year for your programme. Can you explain exactly what you did?
Well, we're a results-based programme, and that involves assessing the habitat quality in a very large number of fields. There's about 19,000 fields in the programme, and that habitat quality has to be measured every summer. So to speed up that process, we developed and introduced an app which is used to input the data into our computers. We also introduced geotagging, which verifies that the data relates to the particular field in question. And we developed a screening system to help farmers ensure that proposed works on their farm wouldn't have any negative impact. These developments are there to inform the development of other schemes in the future that might have a bigger footprint than the Hen Harrier project currently has.
I know that one of the issues that hen harriers have been facing in some parts of Ireland has been related to forestry. So I just wanted to ask you, are measures being taken to try and address that? And what's been put in place at the moment that's trying to help both foresters and hen harriers?
Well, the big challenge there is that forestry occupies about 50% of the areas that are designated for breeding hen harrier. And that creates a lot of challenges for both foresters and for the species itself. So we have to work together to try and address them, and in particular in addressing the disturbance associated with forestry activities. And, you know, we're working very closely with Caoilte and the Department of Agriculture to improve that relationship.
Fergal, thank you very much indeed.
No problem at all. Thank you. Bye now.
Now, I want to draw your attention to some timely words of advice from the Irish Deer Commission, particularly if you live in and around the Phoenix Park and you visit the park regularly, especially if you feed the deer, because they're saying stop feeding the deer. The situation has become out of control. But not only that, it seems that antisocial behaviour is not only endangering the lives of the deer, but also the people involved in it. To tell us more, we've got Damien Hannigan from the Irish Deer Commission, who joins us now from his home in Cork. Damien, how are you today?
I'm very good, Derek.
So tell me, Damien, what's happening in the Phoenix Park that brought you out from under your shell, so to speak?
Yeah, I suppose it's probably important to sort of say just before I answer your question is that the deer in the Phoenix Park, they're a very important part of the heritage of the Phoenix Park and indeed Dublin. They've been there since 1662, which is over 350 years. So a very important part of the life of the Phoenix Park. So I suppose on Wednesday of this week, we received a rather disturbing video. And the video showed a number of individuals, what they call sulkies, and a number of horses. And effectively, they were charging a herd of resting fallow deer that were lying down. And as you can imagine, this caused significant disturbance to the herd. There was deer running in all directions, running across roads and running towards people to try and escape this. So it's something that we're very disturbed to see. It's part of an increasing, number of problems that we've seen in the park and involving the deer, particularly around COVID, where more and more people are using the park. And the deer are there to be enjoyed and to be viewed. But unfortunately, we've seen an increase in the number of instances where maybe people are feeding the deer or taking selfies with the deer. But obviously, this is on a whole different level. And there's been recent media reports that suggest that this has been a regular activity, that these sulkies have been chasing deer in the park, which is of real concern to us.
Now, for the benefit of people who don't know what you're talking about, can you explain what a sulky is?
Yeah, in my limited knowledge, a sulky is a kind of a two-wheel cart that attaches to the back of a horse. So they typically, from the video what we saw, one of these sulkies had two individuals and the other had a single individual on them. And as I said, I can imagine, the stress this was causing for the horses as well to be charged towards a herd of fallow deer. Not to mention, as I said, the stress that it caused for the deer themselves.
Did somebody contact the Gardaí? Presumably, if you've got video evidence, it is just that, evidence.
Yes, yeah, so I think from our point of view, we put an immediate message out through our various social media channels, just in terms of one, highlighting the incident, two, and asking people really to report the incident to on Garda Síochána or to the Office of Public Works who managed the herd in the Phoenix Park and to reach out. And recent media reports since our video we shared on social media would suggest that there is a Garda investigation underway. As I said, this incident has happened more than once. And it's something that the rangers in the park are aware of. And I know it's been investigated as we speak.
Now, most people go to the park with the best of intentions in the world. As you said, a lot more during the lockdown periods because it's within their 5 kilometre stretch and they can stretch their legs there and they can admire the wildlife and soak in the atmosphere. But I have seen one or two ridiculous pictures of people. One woman with a carrot in her mouth and a fallow deer feeding from the other end of the carrot. And I just thought, how stupid can you be? And you want to say to people, stop feeding the deer.
Yes, absolutely. It's mind-boggling, some of the reports and the photographs that we've seen, what people are doing, maybe holding children over deer, as you mentioned, just with carrots in the mouth and so on. But look, the vast majority of people obviously that visit the park admire deer at a safe distance, but a small number of individuals, well-intended in some cases, in particular when people see that feeding a carrot to the deer, they perceive that to be a good thing. The unfortunate thing is that they're actually doing the deer more harm, because what happens is deer associate humans and bright objects such as an orange carrot or other items. We've even seen people feed the deer chocolate and crisps, which is detrimental really to their health. But what happens is the deer begin to associate humans and bright colours with food. And the consequence of that is that we've had examples in the park where deer have consumed large volumes of domestic waste, plastic, paper and so on. And unfortunately, in a number of incidents, this has caused serious health issues for the deer. And unfortunately, some deer have had to be euthanized over this because as a deer, as a ruminant or a grazer or a browser, they browse on vegetation. So if they consume something that's plastic that they perceive to be food because of human contact, that can have significant consequences for their health.
Well, I was up at the Phoenix Park a couple of weeks ago and I was recording some skylarks and I saw a lot of litter around. And it really does annoy me, I have to say. One, that people would actually discard litter. I mean, why you can't take it home with you if you brought it there in the first place. But really, the other issue is that it needs to be picked up too. And I notice this all around the city, that the litter is sometimes just left there for a long time.
Yes, it's unfortunate. And I suppose the park is, the Phoenix Park is the largest inland park in Europe. And there's lots of attractions and things there for people to see. But, they really should, when visiting the park, there's lots of rubbish bins there, or more importantly, take the rubbish home with them, because this can cause issues for wildlife in the park, as we mentioned, in terms of the deer consuming rubbish that is left around. Because of that, increase in human activity or contact with the deer that we're seeing. It's an unintended consequence of that. So really, we would urge people to when they visit the park, to ensure that they do take home all their waste or rubbish with them. And there is a clause within our Wildlife Act to sort of say if someone willfully disturbs a protected species, it's considered an offence. So it's something that people, you know, forget that these are wild animals, and we'd ask them to respect deer and always maintain a safe distance of minimum 50 metres from deer.
Steer clear of the deer in the Phoenix Park or anywhere else you might happen upon them. Damien, thank you very much indeed.
You're welcome.
Speaking of feeding wild animals, I was in Blessington Street Basin the other day and I noticed that they have signs up advising people on what to feed the waterfowl there, in English and in Irish. And it struck me that so many of us are out now on our 5K walks feeding the ducks and other waterfowl in our public parks that it's a good idea that we know what to give them. So here's Terry Flanagan with his report on what to feed our feathered friends.
Well, Derek, feeding wild birds, that's nothing new. So there's records going back to the 6th century and before that even, of people feeding and training wild birds. I must say, my earliest memory goes back to my granny and her feeding bread to the small birds, particularly after breakfast, and going out into the front garden, throwing this bread out, and I was amazed at these tiny little birds that came down. Now, I was only 3 or 4 years of age at the time. I didn't know what they were. They were probably sparrows. I do remember that kind of chirping that they went on with. Nowadays, of course, things have become much more sophisticated and the feeders and the food, they've all changed. But going back to those early days, I remember to my dad going to the park, going to the duck pond and to the basin. I know you're very fond of the Blessington Street Basin. It was always my favourite park in the city. And going there and feeding the birds, and the one thing I remember is how big those birds were. They were absolutely huge to a small child, the ducks and the swans. And I remember we used to feed them, and we fed them bread. And everyone was feeding them, and not just any old bread, but it was always white bread. But I'll tell you one thing, the ducks and the swans, they never complained. Well, today we're more knowledgeable, and we're being advised not to feed white bread to wild birds. Now, let me say first that white bread is not poisonous and it won't kill the birds. However, white bread, although it's high in carbohydrates, it's low in proteins and nutrients. And protein is very important for birds to build muscles and feathers, and nutrients are extremely important, things like calcium and so on. And remember, white bread can be very filling. If you throw some white bread into the water, it expands and it makes the birds feel full, causing them to stop foraging for natural foods, things like pondweed and small insects and water snails. And this white bread, it lacks minerals, things like calcium. And if birds are lacking in calcium, it'll lead to deformed or brittle bones. There's also a condition known as angel wing, and this is thought to be caused by improper diet as well. The wings, they become deformed, the carpal joint grows incorrectly, and the birds can't fly, and eventually they die. And also with excessive overfeeding of white bread, well, the leftovers that end up in the water, they can cause an algal bloom. And this algal bloom will remove all of the oxygen from the water and the pond life will die. And as for mouldy bread, how many people have you seen thrown mouldy bread into a pond for birds? Not only is there very little nutrition in it, but remember this mouldiness is caused by a fungus, and this fungal infection can also kill the birds. So that leads to the question, should we feed our ducks and swans? And what should we give them? Well, the answer is yes, I do think we should be feeding them, because it provides energy when it's most needed, when they've little chance of foraging for natural foods. So think of winter time, short days, cold days, they don't get a chance to get out and about. And if you throw them some food, it certainly will help them. Now, a question I've been asked many times is, if you continue to feed like this, do these birds become dependent on the food? And the answer is no. There was a study done recently by the BTO, that's the British Trust for Ornithology, and it definitely says that feeding birds extra food does not mean that they become dependent on it. However, do try and not feed in areas where lots of people are feeding. This encourages large amounts of birds, which causes an increase in contact between them, and there's also an increase in the amount of droppings, and this can lead to more disease. So what should we feed them? Well, try to concentrate on foods close to their natural diet. Why not try fresh or canned corn, or lettuce, especially if it's torn into small pieces. Barley is very good. Vegetable peelings from home. Rice, either cooked or uncooked. Defrosted frozen peas. Mealworms, or even dandelions. I've even seen people feeding grapes, but they must be chopped up to prevent the birds from choking. Birds are very conscious of their weight. If you lift a bird in the hand, like a pigeon, you'd be amazed at how light it is. And the reason why they're so conscious of this weight is because they have to fly. And the heavier they are, the harder it is for them to get off the ground. Think of when you go on your holidays and you're checking in the airport. And when you get on the plane and you're sitting down sucking the sweet, what's the pilot doing? He's checking to see what weight the plane is, with the passengers and also with the baggage. And then he has to figure out how much fuel to take on board to carry that plane wherever he's going to. Well, birds are very, very similar. The heavier the bird is, the harder it is for them to fly. So they don't really want that white bread because it's so heavy and so stodgy. With the current lockdown, more people are out walking and they're taking a greater interest in nature. So if you have a canal or a pond within 5 kilometres, why not collect some foodstuffs from home? Some lettuce or vegetable peelings or other natural foods. And as you walk along, you can feed the birds. Not only will you be helping them, but you'll feel good for having helped your local population of ducks and swans.
Thank you very much indeed, Terry. That was very interesting. Niall, is that something that you get into Birdwatch Ireland on a daily basis? Questions like, what should we feed the birds? Is bread okay?
Oh, yes, it is, Derek. Very much so indeed. I think that a lot of people now have come to a new appreciation of nature. They want to know how they can help it. And of course, they want to make sure that they're not hurting it as well or doing more harm than good. Feeding ducks and swans and geese and other waterfowl, it's a very good thing to do in areas and parks where they can really help them. But they have to have the right kind of food, because I think that Terry's analogy there of the plane is a very good one. The birds have to find a very fine balance. They need to make sure that they have enough energy in them so they can fly properly. They can keep themselves warm when the nights get cold, because that energy is obviously what keeps them going. Literally, they have a layer of fat underneath their skin. But if they have too much weight on board, it means they won't be as efficient when it comes to, say, escaping from predators, because if they're surprised, if one happens to be a bit heavier than the others, it'll be the one that lags behind. So it'll be the one got by the hawk or the falcon or the fox. It can mean that extra few little seconds getting airborne can make the difference between life and death. So that is very important. If they've filled up too much on junk food or just empty calories, it means that, they won't be so fit and healthy as well. And coming into the breeding season, as those birds will be doing very soon, it means that they may be not fit and healthy enough to look after their chicks properly or to incubate the eggs or all of these other things that are so important that they have to do shortly. And it goes further than that too, because some of our duck species, they'll be migrating away from Ireland soon. And of course, if you're making big long distance flights, then weight is even more important. They have to balance it very carefully. They need to make sure that they have enough energy on board that they can make it to their final destination and still be in good shape when they arrive. But they don't want to be carrying so much weight that it slows them down or makes that flight inefficient, because then they'll be less fit when they arrive back in the breeding ground and can really affect their chances. So for birds, it really is a very fine balance between getting enough food and making sure they don't have too much.
I remember many years ago being out with Richard when he was ringing mute swans. And as he caught the swans, they immediately defecated all over him.
Oh, yes. I remember him telling me about that as well. He said it's like pea soup going all over the place. Very unpleasant. But of course, what those birds are doing is kind of a fight or flight response. In this case, it's a flight response. They want to offload as much excess weight as they can. So they can do that basically by clearing any waste that's in their intestines. That's a few grams less weight, which means they'll be able to take off that bit faster and fly that bit faster to get away from danger. So it's a very, very natural reaction. It seems to be something that's caused by the immediate production of adrenaline. And it's something that many animals indeed will experience. It's a way just to lighten the load. There's also perhaps an element of disgust, quite literally, in it, because let's say a predator like a wolf or a fox or something goes up and tries to grab a swan, and this is what happens. The result is that would be all in that animal's face or in its mouth. It's very unpleasant. It's something that would cause them to pause for a moment and maybe even spit out. And that's the same sort of reaction it has for us humans as well. So it's kind of unpleasant, and it's also offloading extra weight. So there's a very good reason why they do it. It seems it's not even really conscious. It's just a natural reaction that happens. It's a reflex when they feel threatened or frightened like that.
Niall, thank you very much indeed. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Derek. Bye for now.
That's pretty much all we have time for. My thanks to Niall Hatch, to Aineen Ilana, to Terry Flanagan, and to Richard Collins. Our broadcast coordinator is Jarrah Folland, and our researcher is John Bella Riley. Until next week, goodbye.
Mooney Goes Wild is presented and produced by Derek Mooney.